time to unleash your inner cowboy with the Earn Your Spurs podcast. Now, here's your host, Alyssa Barnes.
Hello, and welcome to episode 51 of the Earn Your Spurs podcast. I'm your host, Alyssa Barnes. Since I'm recording this right before Thanksgiving, I just wanted to tell you happy Thanksgiving really quick. I hope you enjoy the holiday with your families. Let's not forget that the Western lifestyle and horses and everything that goes along with it is a total family affair. I tend to be a pretty firm believer that there's nothing more beneficial for a kid than a horse. And I actually recently wrote a blog post about that. If you go to earnyourspurs.com, there's a blog post there entitled Five Life Lessons Ranch Kids Learn for Free. And it gives a few hints about how to instill those life lessons into your kids, even if they don't grow up on a ranch. And before I jump into introducing my wonderful guest today, I just wanted to highlight one of my amazing audience members who sent in an audio clip for this month's episode. This is Mark.
Hi, Alyssa. My name is Mark Bryant, and my daughter is 10 years old, and she has just got into horseback riding. We have no horses. She's been taking lessons for about 7-8 months. I've been listening to your podcast. I own a pretzel company while I make pretzels. On the way to horseback riding lessons last week, I had my daughter listen to one of your podcasts about balancing on a horse. While she was going around, she was doing better than she's ever done. And then she turned to me while she was on the horse, rode by me, and says, "We need to listen to more Earn Your Spurs. Thought you might like to hear that. Thanks. God bless you. Bye."
Thank you so much for sending in that clip, Mark. And more importantly, thank you for taking your daughter to riding lessons. I look forward to some periodic updates on how she's doing. Now, if you would like to submit your own audio contribution to potentially have played on the next episode of the Earn Your Spurs podcast, go to speakpipe.com/EYSpurs and you can record up to a 90-second audio clip. Now, on to the introduction of today's guest. He happens to be one of the only people who is a repeat guest on the podcast, aside from my brother, actually. And you may know him as the host of his own podcast, The Woe Podcast. Now, I love John's story anyway, because he got involved with horses much later in life, and he's really done a lot to improve his horsemanship since he began. And I wanted to have him on the show today because he just recently did something that I thought was really, really pretty cool. Last year, John covered an event on his podcast called the Heritage Trainers Challenge. And basically, it consists of several guys who volunteer to take on training a wild horse and competing at the end of this several-month process. And most of the people that sign on for this kind of thing are professional trainers. It's what they do for a living day in and day out. Now, John is not a professional trainer, and he does not pretend to be one on his podcast. But he was brave, and he decided to enter up right alongside the other guys. So I had him on the show to talk about his experience with his wild horse, and I think you're really going to enjoy this episode. I think John is really inspiring for what he has done, and so many of us are afraid to step up and you know, try to achieve our goals. It's scary. It's scary to put ourselves out there, and especially when we think that we might end up humiliated. But John really inspired me with his confidence, and I hope you enjoy the story as much as I did.
Well, I appreciate you coming back on the show today, John. And it's kind of, it's fun. It's always fun to catch up with you. And I'm really excited to talk about the topic that we're covering today.
Yes. You mean my experience training a wild horse?
That would be the one. Yes. Yeah. And well, before we get started, I just want to let everyone know that, you know, if you want to learn more about John and his podcast, the Whoa podcast, you can check out episode 14 because he was one of the first guests on the Earn Your Spurs podcast back in the teens.
Very much so, yes.
Early days.
And then you and I talk from time to time and we share ideas about podcasting and the horse industry and things like that. So I always appreciate your input and creativity on these things.
Yes, we are a small group of horse podcasters, so we have to stick together.
Yes, we do. Yes, we do.
So, you know, I wanted to have you on today because I appreciate what you did recently and, you know, in relation to the training of the wild horse. And I think it's a pretty inspirational story, especially for those who, you know, might be just getting into horses or they just have some apprehension and, you know, they're a little nervous about things. And I just feel like you took a big leap here. So why don't you start and just kind of tell us a little bit about the event and why you decided to get involved?
Great. I'd love to. The event is called the Vaquero Heritage Trainers Challenge. Everyone knows about the plight of the BLM Mustangs, that you can adopt a Mustang from a BLM facility. But in addition to the BLM horses, the 45,000 horses that they have in holding pens, there's also a number of different privately managed herd of feral and wild horses. And that's the case here in Tehachapi, California. It's about an hour's drive from Bakersfield, where I live. And there's a herd there that's been living there for, they think, between 80 and 100 years. Just to give you a little bit of basic background, there was California was a big cattle country in the turn of the century. In the early 1900s, there was a cattle company called the Tehachapi Cattle Company. And one of the owners of that, Roland Hill, was the largest breeder of Morgan horses in the United States in the early 1900s. And he bred and raised Morgan horses to work cattle on his farm and on his ranch, rather. And I knew you'd catch me on that farm ranch thing. On his ranch. It's like calling a ship a boat. But, somehow these horses got out and they were left on their own devices, and they've got a lot of Morgan bloodlines in them. We don't know exactly which lines, but one did pass away and they did an autopsy, found out it only had 5 vertebrae, which Morgans and Arabs do. And then the herd is entirely black. The herd that produced the horses that in the event that I did were from the Oak Creek region of Tehachapi, and there's about 100 head of horses there, and every horse is solid black. I covered the event last year for my podcast, and essentially it's a 3-day event, very much to Extreme Mustang Makeover. There's a couple of little twists. They gave us our horses on June 14th, and then we had until October 9th to train them and do whatever we were going to be able to do with them. The event was Friday, Saturday, and Sunday. And so Friday morning, they give us another brand new horse off the herd, and they give us an hour session for the next 3 days to train that horse. The competition is scored in two parts: what we've been able to do with the horse we've had for 120 days, and then also what we were able to accomplish with the horse that we had for an hour a day for 3 days. When I covered the event last year, they used very young horses as the new colts, and this year they used two and three-year-olds. When I saw the event last year, I noticed how calm a demeanor these horses had, how trainable they seemed to be, and a lot of the trainers were very much amateur trainers. And when the time came up, earlier this year that the event was they were preparing for, it didn't seem like they had enough trainers. And I had talked to the organizers and interviewed them last year. And as a parting comment, Jeremy Dunn, one of the organizers, says, well, you ought to consider training a horse next year. So when it didn't look like the event might go off because they only had 4 trainers and they needed a minimum of 6, I applied and thought I could handle a colt. They look very malleable and they look very calm. And I thought I could live through the experience, which was my number one goal, And so I applied and I got accepted. And then I got a horse, and he turned out to be a 9-year-old gelding. He was gelded in at the age of 6 or 7. And so I had a few challenges with him, but it was an exciting experience.
Wow. How did you feel when you sent in your application? I mean, were you excited? Were you nervous? Like, what was that like for you?
Yeah, well, but when I sent in my application, I was very confident. I knew that I could handle the horse. I knew that I thought I could train the horse. I had a pretty high confidence level that I would be able to get the horse. There was the mechanics of, we have a half an acre, so I was going to have to move some pens around. I was going to have to get a round pen, which was only going to be 30 feet. I was going to have to get extra hay. And there was all those things. Now, don't get me wrong. I knew that there is a lot that I don't know about horsemanship. And part of my motivation in doing this was to find out exactly how much I didn't know. And much to my surprise, there was a whole heck of a lot more that I didn't know than I thought I did know. So.
I think that's always the way it kind of goes. Now, you mentioned something, and I meant to ask you about it. You said that there are several wild horse herds on private land or around the country. So it's not just this one.
So it's not, yes. And I talked to Mary Kitzmiller, who's a horse trainer in Texas.
Yeah.
I told her that I was going to be doing this. We had interviewed for the show again. I used the show, my contacts through the show to get a lot of advice from different people. But I had talked to her between the time I'd sent my application in and the time I got my horse. And she gave me some really good advice, but then told me that there was a herd that she knew about in Texas that was very similar to the Oak Creek horse herd, that these were feral horses and privately managed, so that they were on, I don't know what kind of property. These horses are on private property, so that's how they're managed.
That's really interesting. I you don't ever think about that because the BLM horses get all the coverage, but that's really neat to know that there's other ones out there. And obviously, you know, you got a 9-year-old horse to start, so they don't have a lot of interaction with humans probably in up until, you know, the time that you guys got them.
He did not. He had been gelded, like I said, in 2013, and that's essentially, they run him through a chute, anesthetize him, they gave him a tetanus vaccine, and then they turn him back out on the herd because there's nothing else they can do with them. Now, they do, with our drought in California, they did supplement some of their feed with alfalfa, so they did get used to coming in for feed. Mm.
And did you have to halter break your horse too?
To go back a little bit, I was very confident when I put my application in, and very quickly that confidence got eroded away because we go up, and this was still when confidence was high, but we drove back to this canyon. It's about 5 miles on a dirt road, and one of the other trainers had been there last year. He says, you're going to love this part of the event. We're driving around, and it's this windy road in the hills of Tehachapi. And we come around the corner and we see 7 black horses running along a lower ridge, just going the same direction that the road is going, but they're about a half a mile away. And they're just running full blast, and they're jumping logs, and they're just going like crazy. And we're in awe to see these horses out running in the wild. And another quarter of a mile down the road, we make another turn. And the reason these horses were running, they were running back to the herd. So we come around this corner over a rise and opens up into a meadow with 100 black horses.
Wow.
It was pretty awesome. And then we had 30 minutes to pick out our horses. We drew numbers. They had captured about 30 horses in a holding pen, and we couldn't go into the pen. We had to pick our horses from the outside. I drew number 8 and I wanted a gelding, and there was one gelding left. And it turned out to be the horse that I had for the next 4 months. They run him through a chute into the back of our trailer. They closed the door. Once that horse got into the trailer, he was mine. So I didn't take ownership of the horse until he got in the trailer. Once he got in the trailer, damage to the trailer or damage to the horse was going to be my responsibility. Mm-hmm. And so that was a little bit scary, but we got him home. And
how did your trailer look when you got home?
It was good. The guy was extremely calm. We had to go out the 5 miles of the dirt road. It was pretty windy. And when we got him home, opened up the back door of the trailer into our 25 by 25 pen that I had set up for him. He walked out, looked around, and says, "Where's dinner?" So I fed him.
So he didn't have any trouble acclimating.
He did not, no.
And what did you end up naming him?
So because it was the very first time I'd ever done that. Good question, by the way. Because it was the very first time that I had ever done this, Alyssa, and because the horses were just covered with all kinds of bite marks and scratches from living out in the wild, since I was starting from scratch and he was covered with scratches, I decided I was going to call him Scratch. Mm. And then to answer your question, it took me about 4 or 5 days to get a halter on him. So I got a halter on him, and then I had to worry about training, how to teach him how to lead, and that took probably another week.
Well, I mean, it's a lot harder to break a horse to lead when they're 9 years old than it is when they're a baby.
So have you done that? Have you started a horse?
I have never halter broke an adult horse. I mean, I've messed with colts and stuff, but never like, you know, I mean, I've definitely had some colts that older 3 year olds and stuff that we were riding that didn't lead very well, but they were somewhat halter broke, you know? But no, I've never had to halter break one that old that's been that, you know, little handled.
It was a challenge because I didn't have, I'm a kind of an independent guy and I wanted to do everything on my own. And I didn't have a whole lot to go on other than I knew that if I kept trying to handle him, that he would have to give in sooner or later. So mm-hmm. I just kind of outweighed him.
Yeah. Yeah, that's always a good method, you know, just outlast him.
That's all I had going for me.
So you had him for, what, 4 months?
4 months.
Leading up to the competition. Obviously, you had to work with him a lot every day and teach him, you know, everything from the very beginning. Were there any, like, particular moments that kind of stand out to you that maybe were the most memorable?
There, you know, the first time that I got on him was a very memorable time. And in the 4 months, he never threw me off of him. He never really bucked out of animosity. He did get a little frustrated with me from time to time, and he did buck from fear, but he wasn't trying to get me off that I could tell. Mm-hmm. And he never did. I don't know if you just heard that plane fly over. I'm recording this from our house. We live under the flight path of an airport, and it's a municipal airport, and there's a lot of experimental planes there. And I had been working with Scratch for about, almost a month when it was time to, I'd gotten the saddle on him. I'd gotten him nice and relaxed. I was bending him. I was flexing him. I had desensitized him. I was basically using the down under horsemanship method, and it was time to get on him. So we had practiced this. I'd got my mare, my quarter horse mare, Jessie, and I pretended she was a wild horse, and we were going to use the two people in the round pen method that Clinton recommends, where one person just stays in the saddle and the other person moves the horse's feet around. So I enlisted the help of my wife, Renee, to have the stick in the flag, and she was going to move the horse around. And like I said, we practiced with my quarter horse, and my quarter horse did amazingly well. So she's obviously broke, but it got time to get on Scratch. And I'm doing all this pre-flight stuff, checking him, flexing him, doing all this stuff. And I've got one foot in the stirrup, and I'm going up and down and patting him on the other side, doing all the stuff you're supposed to do, going through this whole 15-minute process that I've done probably a dozen times before, just never threw my leg over. Now it's time to throw my leg over. And I do. And I just get my rear end settled in the saddle when one of those planes fly over. Now, there's about 10 planes that fly over on an average day that land, private planes. And of those 10, about 1 in 40 will backfire when they're landing because they're throttling back. Very few of them backfire directly overhead. This time, I was lucky because that's exactly what happened. I mean, as soon as my butt hit that saddle, that plane backfired and scratched, said, I don't know what the heck is going on, but I've got you on my back, and I've got a loud noise popping over my head, and he didn't like that at all. So thankfully, I was in a 30-foot round pen. He gave a couple of crow hops and was really just kind of going berserk, and so it was he kind of banged up against one of the round pens, and I just stepped off on one of the panels, and as soon as I got off of him, he calmed down. That was probably the most memorable part, is other than the competition, was that very first ride.
Yeah, and then you kind of had to regroup and start again.
I had to, yes, and I wanted to, you know, that wasn't, it's, from what I understand about starting horses, you really don't want to have too many bad experiences because those are the ones that they tend to remember. So I had to go backwards, and I had to do that a lot in the training. When I made a mistake as far as doing something, I would have to go back to the beginning and then try and start over again. Next time I had a more experienced friend help me to do the first ride, and it went off without a hitch. And that was, we probably waited 3 more weeks before I got on him again.
Because oh, really?
There was the work that I had to do, but then there was also a confidence issue too, because I thought, you know, gosh, I don't want him bucking around. It was, even though he didn't toss me off, it wasn't an easy get. I mean, it didn't hurt me, but it was a pretty scary few seconds that he was bouncing me around.
Yeah. Well, before we get to the competition part of it, what was your goal through this whole process and leading up to, you know, the competition? What did you want to get out of it?
One, I wanted to be able to say that I started a horse. I'd always wanted to do that. I'm in my sixth decade. I'm 61. I'm not going to have too many opportunities to do it anymore. So I thought, first, I thought the time had passed and I wasn't going to be able to do it at all. Then this opportunity came up and I said, you know what? I'm just going to do it while I can. I'm going to be as safe as I possibly can. And then I want to find out how much of my horsemanship skills are really valid. You know, am I fooling myself? Do I know about horses? Do I think I'm just kind of a weekend cowboy, or can I really train this horse who has no real knowledge? Can I take and give him the skills that he needs to have to become a good horse? And that was my main goal, was to find out, one, if I could do it. And I've never been one to shy away from a challenge. The biggest thing in this event was the time commitment. Would I be able to get the job done in 4 months?
Yeah, that's a pretty tight time frame, especially when it's your first horse that you've ever started.
Yes.
Because there's a lot of learning that goes along the way, you know.
I panicked many times.
So how did you feel going into the competition? Did you feel prepared? Did you feel ready?
I didn't. I felt pretty nervous. And one of the things that I'd committed to, even though I was using the Clinton Anderson method for the first 5 or 6 weeks, the event was called the Vaquero Heritage Trainers Challenge. And the Vaqueros were the early, you know, the early cowhands and horsemen. And they used a Bozell and Hackamore setup. And I just said, you know, I could probably train them and do it in a snaffle, but I really want to commit to this Bozell and Hackamore setup and with the Makati reins and try and see if I could do it with that.
Yeah, because let's just make it a little bit more challenging.
Yeah, you know, and I think, see, that, and this is where I kind of would come off the rails. I didn't have enough knowledge to know that that was a silly thing to try to do. You know, people would say, Are you going to put him in a Snaffle? And I said, no, I'm going to kind of keep him in the Hackamore. No one said, are you nuts? Which is what they should have said. They should have said, no, you should put him in the Snaffle. I just thought, you know, hey, I'm kind of following the path of the Vaquero thing. And I didn't really have a good stop on him. I did not. I mean, I had a good stop when he wanted to stop. I could lope him around for 5 minutes. And when I sat down, he would slide to a stop almost. He'd get his feet under him, and it was really good. But if he was frightened or afraid and I wanted to stop him, asking him to stop with my seat, he would just ignore it. And he would just kind of blow through the Hackamore. I couldn't bend him around. I couldn't do anything. So when it got time to go to the competition, I knew that I did not have this one essential ingredient. I didn't have a stop. And I was pretty worried about that.
So how did it end up going?
It went pretty well. He was more nervous. Scratch was more nervous around the crowds than I had anticipated. I'd never really got him into a large group of people like that. And there were loudspeakers overhead. We did the obstacle course from the ground. And that was probably our best performance of the event. He walked over a bridge. He trotted alongside me. He got in a trailer very well. We maneuvered around the cones and the cowboy curtain and all that. The riding part of the competition was pretty tough because I had a right lead, but I couldn't get a left lead. He was really fighting me on that left lead. Again, it was part of the problem was the Bozell setup that I was using. And when I would try to switch him around, he would just fight and run through my hand. So I had to do a little bit of that, instead of using a left lead, I would just trot him through that part of the competition. And he did pretty well there too. We made our way through the gate. We went over the bridge again. We went through the different things. We dragged a log, and we did a lot of good things. He has a great mounting block exercise. We did that very well. And then in the freestyle, I had this notion that I was going to set up Paul Revere's ride. So I got myself a tri-corner hat and a Paul Revere-like jacket, and I'd handed out my support crew had handed out American flags and those little champagne poppers that they do at parties to the crowd. And then I had a Paul Revere song that was playing. And there was going to be three parts of my freestyle. So the first part was Paul Revere. I rode by the crowd and I said, fire! And they all popped their poppers, and Scratch did really well. He sped up, but he didn't do anything more than that. And we were on the right lead. So a right lead. So that was good because he didn't have the left lead. And that was the first 3 minutes of the routine. And then I switched into Western garb and did, I tried to do a couple of side passes and backing up and some other things that were just kind of a total mess. He did do a great mounting block exercise, and that was pretty good. And then the third segment of our freestyle was I took his bridle off. I took the Hackamore off, and then I rode him around. He did fairly well. He preferred to kind of go where he wanted to go, but he kind of let me steer him every once in a while. And then I put a blindfold on and got him to canter a few steps and then got him to stop. And then I pretty much had enough. That was that all went fairly well. And we ended up coming in fourth out of the six trainers that competed. And the three trainers that were ahead of me all make a living training horses. So I was pretty proud of what I was able to accomplish with them.
Well, what was that like for you competing against those trainers that, you know, do it for a living, and obviously it wasn't their first horse that they'd ever started? I mean, did you ever have a feeling of like, what am I doing here?
I had it quite often. And those guys, the people that were the professional trainers, did such a far better job with their horses. They had their horses in much more of a ready state than I did. And I'm not discounting what I was able to do with them by any means, but these guys had lead changes. They had their horses laying down. They were standing on their horses. Of course, I don't know how practical that is, but They showed that their horses, they had control of their horses. Their horses were confident. They were bold and courageous. They did a lot of things extremely well. And one of the best things about the taking part in the competition was I got to watch how these guys worked, and I got to pick their brains in between sessions and ask them questions. And they're all very open and helpful with how they handled it too. So it was a great experience.
That's awesome. I mean, honestly, you accomplished a huge goal for yourself, and I tell people all the time that you can't compare yourself to others and worry about what others think and all that stuff. You know, you have to really set your own goals and set out to accomplish what's important to you. And you absolutely did that. So, you know, you should be proud.
Thanks. And one of the best things about the whole event is that, you know, it's really nice to get praise and have people go, hey, that's a really good job. But one of the nicest things that happened was the man who was announcing, doing all the announcing for the event, is the ranch manager of a 40,000 acre cattle ranch, quite close to Tehachapi. And this man was so kind and gentle. He would see me struggling with something, and he came over and talked to me during one of the breaks. And he said, you know, you're doing a really good job, which I'd been getting a lot of, and I really appreciated the words. But actions do speak louder than words. And he says, I'm going to bid on your horse. And I said, because at the end of the event, there is an auction and a trainer can decide to sell his horse or not. And I had made the decision to sell Scratch before I even entered the competition, because our property is only zoned for two horses and we have two horses. And I just couldn't figure out a way to keep him. And he said, I'm going to bid on your horse. And I said, are you sure? Because, you know, you haven't seen the freestyle yet. And I said, I think he's going to do something crazy in the freestyle. And he says, that's okay. He says, we can fix it. He says, but I want you to know that if I buy your horse, that you have to come along and continue training him. And I said, you know, there's a lot of good trainers here. He says, I know there's a lot of good trainers here, but he says, I've watched you and I want you to continue training this horse. So that was it. That was where a guy actually, you know, he went one step beyond of just, you know, pat me on the back and saying, good job. He said, I'm going to put my money where my mouth is. I have confidence in you. And that really gave me probably the best feeling of the event. That's when I knew that I had done something that was worthy of accomplishment, because here was a guy who was willing to put his money where his mouth was.
Yeah, that's amazing. And I mean, gosh, what a huge compliment.
It was. And then he says, you have to come up on the ranch and ride Scratch around. And for a, you know, kind of a city slicker like me to be able to do that, that's a pretty big deal right there. I mean, I would have loved to have gotten an invitation to his ranch to ride up there, whether it was to train his horse or not.
Right, right. And he did end up buying your horse.
He did. Yes, he did. And he true to his word, he said, I want you to continue training him, take him home, get him in put him in a snaffle, please. and this is how you learn from stuff like this, though, is that when you don't know what you don't know, which there were many times during the last 4 months where I was doing stuff that I didn't even know that I didn't know. Sometimes that can help you, but also it can hurt you. But as when you look back on it, if you're paying attention, you'll learn is that Scratch has made the transition to the snaffle bit in the last 2.5 weeks or so that we've been working together. And it's really transforming him as a horse. He's becoming a lot more confident. He's becoming a lot more trusting. I have the ability to ride him now, knowing that I can stop him again and calm him down. And we're able to kind of now work through some of the issues that we weren't able to work through earlier. And it's a really great feeling to be able to see the transformation that he's making now after long after the event's over too.
That's awesome. So What would you say is the biggest thing that you got out of this whole experience? I mean, what are you looking back on it and saying, wow, that was so worth it because I learned this, or because, you know, I've gained this from, you know, just stepping up and being brave and doing it?
There's a lot of horsemanship knowledge that I learned over the 4 months, and that would be really hard to put into which was the most valuable lesson. But the thing that I'm most proud of is that I did not let age stop me. Is that I wanted to do something, I decided I was going to do it, and I decided that I had to figure out a way to do it safely, and I did. I accomplished that goal. And I could have said, you know, gosh, you're too old for this stuff. You should just, you know, take up something like photography or something that's not going to hurt yourself, because a horse can't hurt you. But I said, you know, I'm not getting any younger. I'm going to do it now. And I set a goal and I accomplished it. And that's the most thing that I'm proud of.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. So I have to ask you, what, like, if you were going to give advice to somebody who is like wanting to do something, whether it's train a wild horse or, you know, whatever the case may be, and they're kind of apprehensive about it, maybe a little nervous or scared or don't have the confidence, but they really want to do it. I mean, what advice would you give them to sort of just, you know, step up?
That's pretty good way you put that question, Alyssa, too, is that step up, is that you take it a step at a time. Now, I had some basic knowledge with horsemanship. I'd been studying horsemanship and doing the podcast, learning from some of the greatest trainers in the country, as, you know, via conversation, but I was still being exposed to a lot of good horsemanship. So I didn't start from a knowledge base of zero, but I did, but, you know, I kind of took it each step at a time. I knew what I had to do, and I would take one step. And when I got a lack of confidence, or I got scared, or I got insecure, I took a break, stopped, thought about what I was doing, got myself back on track, and moved forward again. I took a step, and it may not have been the biggest step, but I took a little step, and then slowly I got back towards my goal. During that 4 months, there were a lot of crises of confidence that I experienced. Mm-hmm. And there were a lot of trainers that I would call and I would ask for help. And almost all of them were very open to letting me bring scratch to their property, come in for a lesson, give me a piece of advice. I got something from, it seemed like every time that I needed something, I got something. And there was a time where I was really kind of struggling with how things were going. I wasn't being able to ride him as much as I wanted to, where I wanted to, in the manner I wanted to. And I was reading, I was listening to a book on tape, and it was Orville and Wilbur Wright by David McCullough. And he was talking about how these guys, everybody else was trying to fly a plane by learning how to fly, by building a plane, flying it, and crashing it. And Orville and Wilbur learned how to fly a plane from the ground first. And they had many setbacks, and they would get discouraged, and they had somebody to kind of boost them up. They had each other. You know, if Orville was down, Wilbur would pick him up. And they learned how to fly from the ground long before they ever got in a plane, which is how they were able to set so many flight records when they first started flying. It wasn't, everything advanced so quickly for them. And I had the support of my wife. Every time I would get down, she would come to me and she'd say, listen, you know, I know you're sure how this is going to happen. But I have one thing that I know for sure, is that you're going to get the job done. Now, it might not be in time for the competition, but I know you're going to figure it out. So each time I ran into some sort of problem, there was always something there. And I kind of knew that going in. I said, you know, I know that if I just keep moving step by step closer to my goal, that whatever happens, whatever universe is out there, it's going to help me get there as long as I keep moving forward. It's only when I stand still that I tend to feel totally lost. So that's what I did.
I love that. That's great advice. And I love the story. I mean, it fits perfectly for what you're doing. And I'm really proud of you, John. Seriously.
Well, thanks, Alyssa.
I think it's awesome that you stepped outside your comfort zone and you took on such a huge undertaking, and you know, you did it. You finished the race, and that's awesome.
Coming from somebody who has had as much experience with horses as you have, and have had the luxury of being around horses all your life, that really means a lot to me too.
Well, I'm glad. And I think with that, we'll go ahead and wrap up here. But before we do, just let everybody know who maybe didn't hear our first interview together, where they can find out more about your podcast and find out more about you online.
Yeah, you can find out about the WHOA podcast. It's whoapodcast.com. That's my website. I did chronicle a lot of the adventures that I had with Scratch over the 4 months, and I did a series of about a dozen different videos from the very first time he got loaded into the trailer to the last of the competition, and those are on my YouTube channel, which is my name without any spaces, and that's John, last name is Harrer, Harrer, on YouTube. And you can see how Scratch did through the competition and really about from where he came from too, because when they loaded him up in the trailer, it's a pretty awesome little sight too.
Yeah, I'm going to have to check that out, because this ranch sounds pretty amazing. Well, thank you so much for taking the time to chat with me today, John. It was great to catch up and great to hear your story, and I appreciate you coming on.
Well, thanks for having me, Alyssa. It's always great fun talking to you.
I hope you enjoyed that interview with John Harrer, and I hope it inspires you to step outside your own comfort zone. If it does, I would love to hear about it, and you can leave a comment on this episode at earnyourspurs.com/episode51. That's it for this month's episode of the Earn Your Spurs podcast. I will be in Las Vegas at the NFR December 3rd through the 6th. If any of you listeners are going to be there as well, feel free to reach out to me and maybe we can hook up. And if you have never left a review for this podcast in iTunes, I would really, really appreciate it if you had a few moments to hop on over to iTunes, leave a rating and review for the Earn Your Spurs podcast. It helps other like-minded people who are looking for new podcasts to find ours in the rankings. As always, thank you so much for listening. I appreciate you, and I will see you during the next episode of the Earn Your Spurs podcast.
Thanks for listening to the Earn Your Spurs podcast. Until next time, happy trails and spur on.